This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast. Hope you are good. Now, this is going to be a DB7 themed one. As you know, it is going to be the DB7's 30 years this year, and we're holding a special celebration at the Aston Martin Heritage Festival on the 31st of August at British Motor Museum at Gaydon. So this is going to be the first of several podcasts we're going to be doing throughout the year. It's going to be DB7 themed, covering just some random points. Now, we've got some very good people around the table to discuss DB7 in the early days. We have John Muirhead, delighted to have John here. He was the marketing manager throughout the lifespan of the DB7. We also have Steve Waddenham, who is the Aston Martin Lagonda official historian, and delighted to have here as well Andrew Burford, has bought an early press car. I believe he bought it in April 1997, and it's a 1995 press car. Andrew, let's kick off with you. Can you talk to us something about the car?
Sure, yeah. I was in my early 30s at the time, and was seen the DB7 in the press and thought, wow, you know, that is a fantastic looking car, and had a very good quarter and I thought, right, you know, I'll go out and get one. And started looking around, and I actually saw a used one. It got 11,000 on the clock. It was only 18 months old. I thought, yeah, that's nice. It's black. It's the right color. And I was looking at a Ferrari as well, an F355. And actually, the Aston just had it for me. It was much more sophisticated. It was more discreet as a car.
So was it your first Aston?
It was my first Aston, yeah. And in fact, I still have it now. So, you know, it's now 27 years old and it's still as lovely for me as it was back then when I first saw it.
Right. Okay. So you say it was black. What colour's the interior?
It's parchment with oxblood.
Talking of colour schemes, John Muirhead, I think he was behind some of the, well, we're not saying some of the press cars, it was probably more the show cars, wasn't it? The colours, how to present these cars?
Yes, but the job of creating the colour and trim was kind of down to me initially. I did have design training, and obviously, you know, it had gone past where Ian Callum and Neil Simpson were involved directly in terms of their design expertise. They created the car and everything else. But then, you know, we had to start to think about practical things like colours of exterior, interior, colour names, and then obviously choosing the right colours for not just press cars, but also motor show cars, event cars. Not that we had that many. I mean, we're talking about a very small number. You know, essentially, the sales and marketing department at Bloxham comprises of about six people. Right. And so we were all involved to some extent in pretty much everything to do with getting this car to market and starting to, you know, to build up sales. In terms of the colours, many of them, of course, were existing colours that we, via the paint manufacturer, we tweaked to make them slightly more, you know, original, if you like. We didn't have the facilities to be able to create our own colours. We didn't have the volumes either to be able to, you know, order paint in the sort of quantities that were going to be needed. And I think initially the first cars were painted by a certain company in Crewe at the time. And so, you know, simply because the paint shop at Newport Pagnell didn't have the capacity. It was designed to build, you know, to paint, what was it, 5 or 6 cars or 10 cars a week. And that was it. And to suddenly start producing or painting DB7s there in any sort of volume just wasn't on. So we had to use outside sources until we could get our paint shop up and running at Bloxham. You know, we wanted to try and create a range of colours that would satisfy most people's needs. And most of them were relatively conservative, I would say, because at the time, Aston's customers were quite conservative. For instance, at Newport Pagnell, pretty much all of the V cars were either British Racing Green or Navy Blue.
I was going to say, with the DB7 being probably a more youthful car, probably appearing to a younger audience relatively, was there a change from the traditional green, Aston Green, British Racing Green, do you feel?
not necessarily, but we didn't just rely on it. Yeah. You know, we had a number of other colours that we wanted to introduce to give it greater appeal. You're right, it appealed to a younger audience, but also it was it's about half the price of a car built at Newport Pagnell. So all of a sudden, it opened itself up to a whole new audience who previously wouldn't have been able to justify a car costing 150,000 to 200,000, whereas the DB7 was around about 78,000, I think, when it first it was first launched. Yes. It was still an expensive car, but it was certainly a lot more affordable than the models that we've been building previously. So essentially, I started to look at the sort of colours we would want and to try and create a range of colours. And then knowing full well that we obviously had to be able to support that, or the paint shop would have to support that. And as I say, we used existing colours that were tweaked slightly until such time as obviously later we were able to create totally original colours when we had moving to Gaydon, we had a full and proper design team headed up initially by Henrik, and then obviously now Marek, a team of professional colour and trim designers. So the job was down to me initially, and in terms of the naming, traditionally the naming of the colours at the Newport Pagnell cars were primarily counties and areas of the UK, like
Chichester Blue,
Chichester, Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
I think was there a Westmoreland as well? I can't remember. But there
Cumberland.
Cumberland, that's right, yes.
One,
So we didn't really want to, we felt that they were probably suitable for the V cars, but for the DB7, we wanted something a little bit more contemporary, but also that kind of tripped off the tongue. So was looking really for colours, names that were either one or two or at most three syllables. So Mendip Blue, Cotswold Gold, Chiltern Green,
it's good to hear
Sky
his names
again, Silver, Pentland Green. And also that they kind of linked in some way. I mean, Cotswold Gold, you know, you think of Cotswold Stone and that kind of gold honey colour that it's in. Mendip Blue, obviously, it's you very often see hills in the distance that have got that sort of blue haze or blue tint. So there was a little bit of a link to that. Islay Blue, that was an island in Scotland. And that, again, another two-syllable
famous for its Bowmore whiskey now.
I'm going to say one we know
very,
well,
very
Gary.
Very famous for its Bowmore whiskey, yeah.
So I remember joking with you at the time saying you're going to run out of hills soon, because a lot of them were hill ranges, weren't they?
Well, they were, but then we went for the Solent, I think, yeah. Solent Silver.
Yeah. Went to Scotland.
Grampian Grey, let me think.
Yeah.
Did you just get a map out and think, well, that's a good name?
Well, initially, no, it just sort of came to me. But then obviously you start to dig a bit deeper and start to come up with other parts of the UK. But I think we were pretty successful in covering, pretty much all the colours for quite a few years. On the interiors, we wanted more to be more descriptive. So hence Oxblood, which is clearly, pretty much what that's going to be. As you will parchment, as you will forest green, as you will olive green. You know, these were all colours that, you would associate with that item. I mean, forests are generally they're green, but with a lot of blue in them. Olives, the opposite, green with a lot of yellow in it, And so you could start to sort of conjure up what that looks like without actually having a colour and trim guide in front of you or colour and trim plaques, which again took time to create and get to all of our dealers, etc. That was the initial intention. A little bit of creativity.
You're making it sound very easy. I mean, you started at the beginning of the podcast saying you had a design background. Was it? You said, what did you do before you joined Aston Martin?
Well, I came straight from Jaguar Sport, TWR Jaguar Sport. So I was already working at Wickham Mill on the XJ220.
Right.
And the same task was given to me on that. So, albeit we only had five colours for XJ220, and they were all named after famous race circuits like Silverstone, Green, yes, Monza, Red, Daytona, Black, Spa, Silver, and Le Mans Blue. And we obviously only had two interior colours, so that was a lot easier. But that's where it sort of, I suppose, got kicked off. And I was, you know, oh, well, you did all right on that. You can do the DB7 ones now, you know. And that really carried on right through, because I remember with, I always try to think of things with a theme. So if we were doing a motor show, we'd want to create a theme rather than just have a random load of colours, coloured cars on a stand. We'd try and come up with some sort of link that linked it all together. And I remember one in particular that I was given a lot of stick over at the time. It was the London Motor Show, and I think it was in, Earl's Court?
Earl's Court, yeah. My first ever car motor show, working on a stand actually by chance, yeah.
And that time we were using quite a lot of wood, because that was very much part of Aston Martin's sort of identity. That has sort of been left over from really the Newport Pagnol days. And DB7 had, you know, quite a bit of veneer interior.
DB7 of shock horror introduced carbon fibre. I mean, what happened to that? I don't know. I mean,
later.
Did that take off? DB7, you could have somebody with carbon fibre too, couldn't you?
On the V12.
Quite successful, especially on grey and silver and black cars with black interior. Looked really good. But yeah, just going back to that motor show, we had a lot of, you know, we had, I think, a timber floor, and we had, you know, various appendages that were produced in timber. So we decided, and because the motor show was in October, we decided to give it a bit of an autumnal theme. So the V8 cars, I'm not sure we had much choice there. I think we had what was sort of built. And as I say, they were all green.
We had a V8
Vantage, a V8 Coupe, and a... probably a V8 Volante.
Yeah.
The long wheelbase Volante.
Yeah.
And they were all pretty much in British Racing green. So in order to sort of brighten things up a bit, I specified two DB7s, one convertible, one Volante, one coupe, in one in gold and one in a sort of autumn bronze. Just before the show opened, I gathered up a load of dry leaves and scattered them around the turntable with the cars to give it that sort of autumnal theme. I got a bit of stick over those colours, but of course they've come into fashion big time, and you see lots of, you know, gold and bronze coloured cars these days. But back then it was quite rather unusual, especially for Aston Martin. And I think one of them took quite a while to sell, didn't it?
I think you had a bit of stick after the show more than at the show.
Yes.
What's he up to with his autumn range of colours?
Yeah, but it wasn't pink or
But you were
purple,
so advanced. But... I mean, those colours, if I remember rightly, one of them was a Peugeot colour and one of them a Volvo colour?
No, because
They were similar though, weren't they?
I was actually a design student with Peter Horbury, who, of course, became head of Volvo. And I know they'd just launched one of their models in a very similar bright bronze colour. And I did remember contacting him and saying, you know, would he mind? Because it was sometime after, this motor show was sometimes after that, I think. Would he mind if we sort of used it and maybe just tweaked it slightly so it wasn't the same? And he said he'd rather not, because the car was still relatively new. And I said, well, not to worry, we'll create something similar, but not the same. And that's what we did. And then quite a bit later, with V8 Vantage, the car that came out alongside DB9 at Gaydon, the first two cars we had as sort of pre-production cars were red and silver. And so they were the only cars we had to actually launch the car. These were, in fact, the roadsters. So I came up with a theme of fire and ice, you know, because we had a red and a silver car. And then we decided, well, where are we going to shoot the car? So we thought, well, where can we go where there's a sort of fire and ice bit? So Iceland came up, and also, in fact, I think one of the Canary Islands, the one that's got a lot of volcanic activity. But in fact, what we did was we just did both in Iceland, and we created the fire element of it using long gas pipes and a rather crazy explosives expert who was there to light these things up. And of course, you had this fantastic background of you know, glaciers and, you know, all the famous sites you see, and, you know, the lagoon, the iceberg lagoon. And, you know, that was an example, if you like, of using a theme to run through everything. And of course, it was quite literally quite cool. And we had a couple of professional models as well, because we thought we'd want to give it a bit of a lifestyle element. And one of them was Rupert Penry Jones, who you probably remember from Spooks.
Yes.
And Amelia
Fox.
Fox. Yes, Amelia Fox.
Yeah, I remember seeing some photo. I don't recognize.
He must have had a budget back in those days, then, John.
Well, it wasn't a great deal. I mean, obviously, it was more than we had in the DB7 days, but it still wasn't, you know, BMW money or Mercedes money. It was still done on a relatively shoestring. But the results were, I thought, pretty good. And then later when we did DBS, we had a silver car that we'd produced to use as photography. And we decided to have a theme of thunder and lightning for that one. So we chose Scotland and Prague. The Prague element was done mostly in the evening when it was quite dark and gave it a pretty sort of gothic feel. And obviously Scotland, but it's wonderful landscapes.
Oh, I remember that one. Yes, it was very dark.
And, you know, the landscapes were brilliant for that car. And of course this, I think it was either Sky Silver, I think it possibly was. I can't remember now. I'd have to check back, but it really punched out of the landscape in this bright silver, which of course suited the car as well, because it was, you know, by a lot of standards, it was a highly technical car.
Was that the DBS? That was the DBS. Yeah, it'd be lightning silver. Lightning silver, yeah. You said DBS. So I'm just thinking for the one or two people who are shouting at the podcast going, it's lightning. But it's because it's become quite a well-known colour. But one thing I remember, John, I don't know if you remember this, but DB7 Vantage, new range of colours, and one of the colours was called Grasmere. Now, I think it became Grasmere Blue, but it was originally going to be Grasmere Green, but it was like a kind of a
turquoise.
Well, it's like a mallard colour, and it kind of, one minute it looked blue, one minute it looked green.
Yeah.
And
I do remember.
Because you'd been, you know, you'd ordered all the colours, you then had to sit down and order a bunch of cars to support the launch. And so one of the cars was going to be this colour. But you'd obviously thought, you know what, I'm going to play it safe with the interior and go for non-green or blues so that it doesn't clash. So you came up with an interior that was effectively a tan over a parchment, but it had a green carpet. And anyway, when the car was
built... Sounds all right.
Yeah, and it looked all right. But when you opened the door, the green carpet made the paint look blue, where it was meant to look green. So I think we hastily renamed the colour. And the car was then like a hot potato. Nobody wanted to take this. There was a handful of cars that were up for grabs for various things like press cars and engineering. And this poor lone car was like being like picked last for a team, you know. And so it was surplus. And the only car available to the parts department was this car. And we needed a car to shoot for the accessory brochure. So we had this car, we spent days with it, putting luggage next to it and all these different shots that we did. And the car actually looked all right, you know, in the pictures, it kind of looked all right, but you never really noticed the clash with the carpet and the paint, because it was either exterior photos with the wheels on and exhaust, stuff like that, or it was interior photos. Anyway, unbeknown to all of us, we all thought we got away with it. The car did its job, brochure came out. And fast forward a few months after the launch of the car, and I get told of someone coming in to see the car being built, and it is a replica, exact replica of this one from the brochure. So I thought to myself, why on earth did anybody order that again? So anyway, I waited for the client to turn up. He came in, took the guy down to show him his car, and opened the door, kind of almost shut my eyes and did a kind of a fingers crossed behind my back, opened the door, waiting for him to say, oh my God, the carpet's the wrong colour. But he didn't. He just went, wow, yeah, it looks great. And I said, is that all okay? Yes, yes. Is that what you wanted? Yeah, absolutely. And then I said to him, just out of interest, where did you get the colour scheme from? He said, oh, from the brochure. He said, I thought to myself, if that's what they recommend in the brochure, I'll have that. So he ordered a duplicate of the car in the brochure. So we ended up with two of these things, and I never saw it ever again. So it must have all been all right. But
well, very often we were specifying a light coloured leather to make the seats stand out, you'd have a darker color carpet. So it's quite logical. You know, you've got a dark green car, dark green carpets, and a light tan or a parchment interior, and that punches out the seats. It just got sort of started to get complicated when, you know, dashboard tops started to get to go light and people were getting reflections of the windscreen. Yes. And we had to say, sorry, we can only do dark colours. And
also, it's before the configurators were born. So you occasionally had to build a car to kind of see what it looked like. Yeah, you know, in a way, it's a leap of faith. You kind of look at swatches and you thought, well, it should be okay. And then the car was built, wasn't it? You know.
Well, we created a colour and trim box.
I was going to say, is it the one with the curved case? Was it slightly curved?
Yes.
You was behind that, were you, John?
I was, yeah. I mean, again, some people complained that it was rather heavy, but I mean, it was a case that was designed to stand on a stand in a showroom, in the corner of the showroom, rather than, because you've got to remember that at that time, we were actually sharing showrooms with, you know, that company in Coventry and some Italian brands, you know, so you didn't have a lot of space to have a big colour and trim wall because we weren't really at that time able to justify it. So, and also a lot of our customers, they didn't bother to go into showrooms. You know, the dealer would have to come to them to their house or their place of work to choose the colour and trim in order to, you know, finalise the order. So we created this colour and trim case. And in true Aston tradition, you know, it was well built. It was pretty solid. And but some people complained it was a bit heavy. But to be honest, it fitted into the boot of a car. You know, all right. You needed to sort of flex your muscles to lift it out again, but take it into the deep.
Didn't it fit in the boot of an EB7? That was the idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, it fitted in there.
So
perfectly.
If you were going off to see a customer, you'd pick it up from the showroom, put the clothes sign up, bearing in mind that you're off to go and see a customer, and you take the case with you. And
well, you could. I mean, you could leave it in the boot, open the lid, and actually view it in the boot of the car if you wanted really wanted
so,
to.
So forget getting golf clubs in the back of an Aston Martin. It was this huge trim box.
Mm.
Yeah.
Famous use of it that I had, I remember being at a motor show when a gentleman came over from BMW and said, Mr. Pitcher's Rider, was he the, he was the...
Burnt. Yes,
yeah.
He was the...
Pitcher's Rider.
Pitcher's Rider, I think he looked towards buying Rover at the time. Is that the same guy we're talking about?
Possibly after that. Anyway, he wanted to order a Vanquish.
Okay.
And he said, would you mind coming over to the BMW stand with some colours. So I picked the case up and trotted over to up the stairs into the BMW sort of inner sanctum and opened it up. And he sort of chose his colours, and that was that. And I think he took delivery of the car eventually, but I wasn't there for that part of it. But I found that rather amusing that the head of BMW should order a van. I mean, it was all quite discreet, you know.
Yes, I imagine it would be.
We used to often have people that you weren't meant to, because of their affiliation with other car companies, you could never breathe a word of who they were or where they were from. But that case was a work of art, because when you opened it up, and it was made at Newport Pagnell, wasn't it? It was made in the trim shop.
But most of it was, yes. I mean, that was part of the attraction when things are a bit quiet, or if the trim guys had some leftover materials, that they could create the metal paint plaques and the carpet samples edged in leather, the leather samples themselves all put onto backing with a little color name on the back. I mean, it was quite a process to go through, and I remember, you know, actually physically putting these things together, because
I remember helping you. I was thinking about it.
Helped. Yeah.
I reckon I spent my birthday once with you in the trim shop at Newport with piles and piles of brand new paint samples, putting the label on the back of them. Because we were in those days, it was like, well, who else is going to do it? You know, there isn't like an army of people. So we spent, I think, my birthday putting the colour names on the back of these panels. I mean, that's only just come to me this afternoon as we're talking. But the genius of the case was when you open the lid up, so you've got leather straps that held it shut. And then once you opened it up, you would then take out you'd thumb your way through all the colours. And then once you were
You
start with a paint colour, you'd hook it up. There was a row of hooks, wasn't there, on the top.
Hooked it up.
So you could hang it all up and go, well, there you go, there's your paint, there's your carpet, there's your upper leather colour, lower leather colour.
So you could put together like a little, sample board, if you like, of paint, leather, wood, because we had little wood veneer little samples woods, as well, carpet, leather, Alcantara. I think we had everything, didn't we?
Yeah, I think it was all in there. The whole car was in there. But one amusing story, and I hope, I really hope he's listening to this podcast. And if anyone knows him, get him to listen to this bit. Our dear friend Alan Baker, salesman in Mayfair, and I went in to see him one day because we always used to send out updates of colour updates, you know. So every so often there'd be a new colour, and you might get two or three of these things for the post, and you were meant to open up your colour trim box and put them in, you know. And I walked in and I casually opened up the box to have a look through it, and half the colours were missing. There was only half the number of normal colours in there, and there were greens and blues and greys and silvers and no kind of funky colours, no reds or oranges. So I said to Alan, where are all the other colours? And he went, they're not available in Mayfair. So Alan would sort of weed them out and throw them in the bin, basically, and say they're not available. So you can only order proper colours, as Alan would call it. Yeah. So yeah, I hope he's laughing his head off listening to that. But he was probably winding me up. They're probably in the office around the back. But they were great bits of kit, those boxes. I think there was a special version done later when the Vanquish came out, before we had the big colour chart, you know, the big colour and trim displays for the showrooms. You got some black ones done. So they were, rather than being dark green, like the DB7 case with walnut capped ends, the more updated version was a black leather
Mark
box.
Two.
The Mark II, yeah, with like carbon fibre ends, funny enough. Because, of course, if you're going to go and look at a Vanquish for somebody, you don't want to turn up with this big green thing with wood ends on it. So there was a kind of modernised version done.
But yes, it was particularly for Vanquish and I think even early DB9.
Yeah. So I was going to say, how long did this trim box last? When did it start?
Probably last. They're probably all still
still out there
somewhere. Yes. A few appeared at the auctions that we used to have at Newport Pagnell, the Bonhams auctions. And amazingly, people bid quite high prices.
Well,
for them.
We had one at Bloxham. So in the days of DB7, if a customer came to order a car at the factory in the early days, we had a tiny little area outside the office of where Bob Dover had his office. It was then effectively in a corridor inside the farmhouse, and there was like this little area. And again, I'll make John laugh at this. There were some uplighters that in the summer would fill up with flies, and they'd all be sizzling away and barbecuing, and you had to flip those things out before a customer arrived. And there were a couple of these little wooden tables, sort of square coffee tables, two of those, and some little tan leather club chairs, and then the colour and trim box, you know. And this is in a really low ceiling, you know, what, 17th century farmhouse? It's pretty old, wasn't it?
Oh, elite, yes. I would say it was probably sort of 16th or 17th century barn.
So that's where you would sit. You would go walk around the factory with people, and then you'd come back and get all the colours out of the box and lay them on a coffee table. And, you know, and that's how we used to take orders at the factory for cars until probably about 2000-ish, when we modernised it and spent a bit of money inside the barn and had a big wall. Probably about the time after Vanquish had come out, actually, thinking about it, would have been a big full-size wall display constructed and made it more sort of modern. Long, long before configurators were even thought of, really.
Growing the passion, sharing the stories. The Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
Steve, you mentioned factory tours. I mean, you was based at Newport Pagnell. Now, I think most people know you from when you used to do factory tours at Gaydon. Were you involved with the DB7 tours?
Yeah, so it started for me at Bloxham. So my first factory tour was at Bloxham. My first proper official factory tour was at Bloxham. So the reason I got into it was I'd been a buyer at Newport Pagnell, a production and then later an aftermarket buyer. And in those days, in order to get anybody to supply us, you had to like warm them up and soften them up, because a lot of people knew our reputation of, you know, of sort of being dubious when it came to paying for things or even ordering tiny quantities, you know. So we developed a way of when a new supplier came in, or somebody that we were trying to get back in with, pick them up from reception and walk through the factory. And then, of course, people would go, wow, this is amazing. How many of these things do you say you build a week? And, you know, so this was in the Virage era. So I used to do that for suppliers. And then one day was asked if I would look after a customer that was coming in and nobody else could see him. So that was my first ever customer tour, which I think was about 97. Yeah, about 97 would have been a V8 Volante long wheelbase. Anyway, so I did that. And then 2 years later, 99, we'd closed the factory to visitors for about a year, building up to the launch of the Vantage version of the DB7. So there was a big backlog of people that wanted to come round. And a lot of people were saying, well, I'm not ordering the car until I come in and see a few colours. So everybody at Bloxham, I think the usual thing, John, was yourself or Wendy would come down from the office and pick up whoever turned up and take them round. And, you know, it'd always been a bit more ad hoc. And so the idea was, well, rather than disturb everybody that's busy, let's borrow Wadders for half a day each day to help clear the backlog. And when it's all clear, then we'll work out what we do afterwards. So that was it, really. I was told to go over to Bloxham and somebody would meet me and show me round, and then I would do my first tour. So I literally arrived at about 8:30 in the morning, met the marketing manager at the time, a lady called Frances, and she said, right, come with me and I'll show you around the factory. And I'd only ever been to Bloxham a handful of times, really. So she showed me around the production line with a 3 pages of A4, which had all the, this is where we fit the doors, this station is where we fit the fuel tank, etc. And she kind of read through it all. And then at the end of it, said, well, there you go. They're the notes. You've got about an hour before this bloke turns up. So you might want to walk around again. So I thought, you bet I do, you know. So I then went back around and spoke to all the chaps building the cars and double checked all the facts and figures. And then folded up the bit of paper, shoved it in my pocket, walked up to reception and picked up my first ever factory tour victim, customer, whatever you want to call him, and took him down, showed him his car. I was very lucky because the dealer was Stratton Motor Company in Norfolk, and Charlie Skelton was very experienced as a car salesman, and he was with him. So he helped me deal with this guy, and that would be my first ever tour. And that was it. And so I started doing it part-time. Then it kind of grew into every day. And what was going to be 3 months became 6 months. And then eventually at the end of it, it became a full-time job.
Andrew, did you manage to get to Bloxham? Did you see Bloxham at all?
I didn't actually. Now, I did see a fabulous movie on YouTube, which I think you put together, Steve, where you can really see what was going on inside the 90s. And I've been to Gaydon, and Steve's done the factory tour at Gaydon, and it's incredible to see those two differences, you know, what 25 years makes in terms of techniques and the way things are done. And no, I love that video. I thought the Bloxham factory tour video is fabulous.
Yeah, we did that together.
We did, yeah. I roped John into that. It was quite a funny story. So I did the first part on my own, and then the second part, I thought, I'm going to get John involved with this. And we turned up on the day and they were digging a road up outside the plant, and then an ambulance went past and the noise was horrendous. So we gave up and we went back to John's garden, and I think there's a scene of me knocking on the door and John, oh, come on in, Wadders, you know, and we sit in the back of John's garden and we finish off the rest of the film. But I mean, it was your garden. It's only a couple of miles away from as a crow flies.
Well, as a crow flies, it's probably less than a mile, directly across from Wickham Mill.
And your house is made from the same type of Cotswold stone.
It is, yeah.
So, you know, all kind of...
And the furniture the same level, is it?
bathrooms in...
green carpet in the hallway.
Yeah. I've had all that before, don't worry.
But John and I, we've both done loads of tours between us, and John still does two tours when asked to as well. And I packed it in back in 2019, and I think I totted up. I did about 5,000 or so factory tours over the years.
Incredible.
Yeah. So, I don't know how many John's done.
Well, I mean, I just can't stress how important an asset it is, because everybody who goes around the factory, pretty much regardless, are so delighted at the end of it. Now, you know, that's a lot of it's just good PR. I mean, they pay to do it now. It's a, you know, there is a, a fee to be paid. I think if it's a, and it has to be through an Aston Martin dealer, so they have to sort of organise it to make sure that, you know, we're not having, you know, football teams coming around, or, well, perhaps football teams might be a good thing, I don't know, but, you know, not having, not being overawed with it. But I can't stress how good an asset it is.
Did you think that, yeah?
I always have, yeah. You know, you think about it, if you're interested in, I don't know, watches and in particular, I don't know, IWC or Rolex, and you go around, you're shown around their factory and shown all the processor, you'd be absolutely knocked out and you'd probably want to buy another watch, you know. And it's the same with the factory tour at Aston. If it's done right and you know, the reception has all been completely remodeled recently. And it really is, you know, very, very striking when you walk in. And you've got the street, which has a row of historic Aston Martins, starting with A3 was there for a while, wasn't it?
But Cloverleaf, was it?
With Cloverleaf, I think it is.
We've had Cloverleaf in there. We've got a car in it at the minute.
You know, right up to Valkyrie. You know, that's like 100 years of development of the car. So from A3 to Valkyrie, I mean, you know, it's unbelievable.
I think the models in between. That street's so important. I've always felt that a lot of people, I've said this before, perhaps on another podcast, some people don't realise how old Aston Martin is, how much history.
No, I think a lot of
things, they seem to think it starts with DB5. It
starts with David Brown. Yeah. I mean, that's only half a century ago. You know, another half century before that. But it really is. And you know, I think there's a lot of other brands do the same now, don't they? I know Bentley do, and Ferrari do, McLaren probably do. But I think we possibly started it all.
I think so.
I don't remember other brands having done that. In the same way that we've always restored cars of ours. You know, you've now got Classiche, you know, you've got Land Rover, Jaguar restoring old Mark I Range Rovers and E-types and stuff like that. You've got Bentley, I think, even maybe started restore older cars. Well, we've always done it. You know, Works have done it right from the very beginning. It's almost like it was, you know, part of building cars. You build them and then you restore them 40 years later or 50 years later and keep them going.
The customer experience of going to Newport Bagnall to have a service,
seeing
these engineers and also the older cars that are going through being restored is fabulous. You know, I used to love my visit out there just to collect the car.
And going to the heritage, you know, area at the back where completed, you know, cars they've been restored or they're just in there for a, you know, a bit of a trim change or a different set of wheels or whatever. Just fantastic. I mean, you know, to anybody who loves cars, even to those who don't, you know, it really is impressive.
Yeah.
Amazing sight.
Did you enjoy the tour? So I was going to say, does it get a bit samey after a while? Because every person you take is going to be different.
Absolutely. That's it. Absolutely. And, you know, when they're excited, they're anticipating a good hour and a half or 2 hours, you know, of seeing the factory. And, you know, you get off on that. It's, I just like meeting people and, especially enthusiastic people who love Aston Martins, and it's very, you know,
it's very personal,
it's a two-way,
isn't it?
It's a two-way thing, really.
Yeah, what goes on tour stays on tour as well. There's an element of people would tell you things, particularly people you'd met before, and open up to you, and you know. So people used to watch us disappearing off to do a tour, thinking, "How on earth do they do that day in, day out, twice a day?" But they didn't realise that every time we did a tour, it was different. And particularly when it's repeat business and you've got people coming back, the first half an hour is just catching up on how are you and how's your family and that sort of thing. And then people would confess all and tell you all sorts of big things. I mean, sometimes life-changing things that were happening to them. And the reason they would tell you that was because they might be the reason why they were changing the car or what they wanted. You know, one or two times I've had people order exactly the same car again because they didn't want anybody else to know they'd changed the car.
It's just always been a pleasure. And I mean, I think I did 26 years of motor shows, you know, Geneva Motor Show and LA and Detroit and Shanghai, Tokyo, Frankfurt, Paris. And, you know, you'd go back again and you get the same people coming and saying, I remember you from last year, or, you know, can you show me what's new this year? And I remember Jackie Stewart was always on our stand in Geneva for the Geneva Motor Show. So it'd be, you know, good morning, Sir Jackie, how are you? You know, oh, very well, sir, John, you know. You know, and he'd sort of be very interested in looking around the cars. And I remember Roger Penske coming into the headquarters at Gaydon, and I was standing by the reception there. This is years after I'd left. And obviously I'd met him quite a few times at the US shows, because obviously he's one of our biggest dealers in the US, and you know, him coming over and saying, hi John, how are you doing? And I thought, you know, how does he remember who I am, you know? But just simply through seeing each other at shows and things.
What about the Terminator as well?
Oh, the Governator.
The
governor of the LA show.
The Los Angeles show, when Arnie was the governor of, and John sent, little picture he took over your shoulder of Arnie with all his bodyguards walking around our stand. And I think John sent it to me and it went, the Governator's here. But yeah, we would get all sorts of people, particularly in LA, we'd get movie stars walking on to the show stands. And again, luckily, because of I knew John for many, many years, worked together, and John got me involved with the motor shows as well. And had great,
well, mainly
great
because
fun.
You know, what you don't want to do is people being there at the show and just sort of hiding in the lounge or standing at the back. And, you know, you need people who are going to kind of go to the, you know, the barrier, if you like, and talk to people and encourage them to come on and see the cars and just engage with people. I mean, that's, you know, it's a very simple task, but to a lot of people, it's a bit, you know, a bit scary. Whereas, you know, we'd had plenty of practice with factory tours. So
yeah, I'm not sure. Going back to motor show, I think when was the DB7 Volante launched? 96?
Yeah, 96, yeah.
And it was launched simultaneously at Detroit and at
LA, yes.
No, you was at LA.
I was at both.
You was at both. I think I was at Detroit. I was going to write a piece for the Aston Martin Owners Club. It's called It Would Be All Right on the Night, about the pre-show prep for the launch of these cars. And someone suggested to me at the AMO, says, well, as you're going to, you know, LA, why don't you just ring the area rep in America, LA, and see if he would like to come along? I thought, well, that'd be nice, you know. So I dropped him an email. I think emails were around then or whatever. And I said, I'm Gary Taylor. I'm going to LA Motor Show. DB7 Volante is going to be launched. You know, come and say hi. I'd be lovely to see you, and perhaps we can get you on the stand. That was the end of it. And the night before I was leaving Detroit to go to LA, he messaged me. I can't remember how he messaged me. He says, great, Gary, I've got 30 people coming. They're so excited. I think, how am I going to tell John this? And you were so welcoming, because I went up to you. I hardly knew you. I said, good and bad news. And this swarm of people turned up, and you was most welcome. So thank you for that. I could have died on the spot. Yeah. It was a good turnout.
It's actually better than having nobody on the stand. I mean,
it was all part of it, wasn't it? I mean, sometimes you'd get maybe a famous person or a dignitary, and you'd get kind of tapped up on the shoulder of like, right, you need to empty the stand, particularly if it's a member of the royal family. So you'd let all the people on the stand go off, and then once it was clear, close the gate, and then along comes whoever it was, and you let them all on, and then 10 minutes later, you let them all off again, and then refill the stand with the kind of great and the good.
I mean, luckily enough, all of our stands always had a glass handrail around with usually a couple of gates, and, you know, people usually pretty understanding. You say, look, you know, would you mind we just closed for a few minutes to
We had a Bond villain 1 year, do you remember? It was so funny. I think it was 2000 at the NEC, the what would have been the launch of Vanquish, but was cancelled and put back to 2001, and as a result you'd booked a big stand, so a 5-car stand, and we ended up with a Le Mans Vantage in the middle, which was going to be the flagship, because Bill had said, don't just turn up with 5 DB7s, it'll look like the DB7 car company. Mm. So we had a flagship Le Mans on the stand, which was already sold, and then 2 DB7s either side. And the guy on the gate had been a stuntman and an actor. you know, a kind of a, an extra. And he'd been in one of the Bond films. He'd been one of the bad guys, you know, with a, it was a scene where Brosnan walks into a nightclub and he's got a pair of like bluey tinted glasses and he looks at all these guys and he can see all the guns underneath their jackets.
Oh, it's an extra.
And this, and this guy was one of them. And he was our doorman for the motor show. So we had this real life Bond villain letting people on and off the stand. I mean, you can't make it up really, can you?
I remember also, John, I think I helped out, again, it was for the AMSC magazine. I think, I'm not sure if it was DB7 was just about to be launched or had launched. It was at Olympia or Earls Court. And I said, could I help out on the stand? For the article.
Yep.
And I think we had a Virage, and I think a DB7 was, I think it was there. But what amazed me was, it was just you and me. Setting up. When I mean, you don't underestimate, you tend to think of this army of people. All right, the stand was set up. I say the stand was set up, I'm saying loosely. It was built, but there was debris everywhere or bits, boxes. It was just, and we were driving the
bringing cars in.
Driving the cars off the transporter. I think you said, right, Gary, you drive this Virage on. Oh, okay. And we were driving through the hallway. With the cherry, minding the cherry pickers and that sort of thing.
Oh, forklift trucks.
The forklift trucks. Yeah. It was, I was amazed that, you know, and effectively it was just you. Then on the show day, when the show's opened, the rest of the people arrived.
Well, John would always do the opening part of the show, press day and all those sort of things. And I used to do the graveyard shift normally with Will Green. So Will and I went off around the world for a couple of years doing shows and we'd always end up doing the last, sometimes 10 days. I mean, I remember doing Paris for 10 days, 12 hours a day, you know, in a country where your first language is French, obviously, you know, and that was really hard work. But on the very last day, and again, John will know what I mean by this. On the very last day of a motor show, normally from about sort of 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, some of the people on the stand start bibbing the horns, and it ends up with like a big crescendo.
Cacophony.
You can barely hear yourself thing. And it's a way of getting the public to basically do one and leave the hall. So there we are. We're surrounded with all these angry French people that have had enough and all the horns are going. And John phones up and goes, can you just make sure that when you pack up that you wash everything up properly, and because it's all got to go to wherever it's going next. Yeah. And so we had to, there we are with our sleeves rolled up.
Marigolds on.
We're washing up liquid, washing all the vases, and then packing them, drying them all up with a tea towel, packing them all away into the boxes. I mean, there's no glamour. I mean, if people on the Skoda stand were opening champagne and probably going off for a massive night out in Paris, whereas Will and I were sleeves up, doing a washing up, basically, and then had to drive the cars out of the show into the streets to put them on the lorries.
To load onto trucks.
And, of course, we had no trade plates, so... And again, I think I'll make John smile with this one. Our local dealer got a lovely guy called Alain. And Alain, I said, don't worry, I'll sort this out. And a little Frenchman turned up with like a little fag on the end of his lip. And he got these old secondhand number plates under his arm and a roll of sellotape. And they were just probably any old number plate that he could find. And we were sellotaping them onto the cars.
Just to make it look...
To make them look like they were registered. And we drove out into Paris, you know, into the streets with these cars and handed them over to the truck drivers. And that was that. But by the time we'd finished, it was midnight, you know.
Yeah.
So back to the hotel for a beer and a few olives and a cheeky cigar maybe. And that was it, you know. But I wouldn't have wanted to do it any other way. It was more fun doing that. And all of us had a great time.
Evite motor shows are important because they seem to have lost their way now.
We kind of did. I think we really only did it big time when we were part of Ford, and Ford kind of insisted that the whole portfolio of brands be represented. And because we were the kind of jewel in the crown, we usually got a fairly prominent position, and we created a new CI by then. It was first, if you like, piloted at the Detroit Motor Show. You know, the use of travertine marble for the floors, lots of white space, lots of use of glass handrails, glass offices, etc. All the furniture was, you know, Bauhaus style, Le Corbusier, you know, Mies van der Rohe chairs and that sort of thing, tables, etc. So it was all very kind of, I suppose, modernist. would be the term, and that was piloted then, and you know, we were obliged. Thankfully, Ford helped us immensely by funding it, you know, because we were all part of the group, and we'd be there with Volvo, Jaguar, Lincoln, Ford, Mazda. You know, it was all part of this sort of group, and we almost, I think, in the end, virtually had a whole hall just to ourselves in some instances. So I think in terms of PR and sending the right messages to the media and to the public that we are, you know, we're here to stay and we're big time. Look at us, you know, look at what we're presenting here. I think that was particularly relevant. In terms of car sales, no, not particularly. Detroit was never really a sales platform anyway. It was more of a
Geneva.
Geneva was, yes. Yeah, Geneva definitely was.
LA, London, Paris, so, was, yeah, Paris, yeah.
And yeah. Frankfurt to some degree. Mm. But, you know, whether you'd have, if you'd not spent all that money, you know, but fortunately, as I say, we were subsidized significantly by Ford. So, you know, to us, it was a no-brainer, really.
We did a podcast with Richard Hayes, and we covered briefly the DB7. And I remember it being launched at Geneva in 1993.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fairly modest stand, actually, in the centre of the hall. And it won Car of the Year, or Car of the Show, I should say.
And Vignale, the Lagonda Vignale was upstairs, and that was launched at the same time. And I think I think Jackie Stewart had a shotgun and a load of sunflowers. Wow. And he fired this shotgun in the air, and all the sunflowers went like
Imagine
that
with health and safety. We're going to get a shotgun.
that was part of the. I'd only just joined. I mean, I was involved sort of initially to a small degree in the preparation to it, but I didn't actually go to that show. It was from 1994 onwards that I did pretty much every one, maybe bar one or two.
We normally sell the cars as well, particularly we were overseas.
Oh, they'd all be sold.
Yeah, everything was built for the show, and then we'd sell it while we were there. You know, we didn't come out with anything.
Because, I mean, especially Geneva, because you've got Italian dealers, French dealers, German dealers, and Swiss dealers, you know, all in that hall. So, you know, they had, and of course, you know, we try and work out a rota whereby different dealers from those countries had a day or had 2 days. And you know, they would see it as a, you know, a big opportunity for them to get some sales.
What about the press cars? Because obviously, Andrew, you've got a press car. Would they eventually, were they used and abused badly? And
how
did you feel about selling them on?
I wouldn't say abused. I mean, the cars were looked after incredibly well. Mm. I mean, before they went out to any media, they were prepared to, you know, 100%. In pretty much every way. And then when they came back in, you might find there's been a dinged wheel or the tyres might have been worn down a bit by Top Gear probably doing donuts. But, you know, generally, I mean, they're pretty tough cars anyway.
Yeah, I would say.
I'd recommend
one, if ever anyone gets offered one, you know, don't even hesitate. It'll be a car that's been maintained beyond any normal level, you know, and really well looked after, always well built, always quality checked on top of all the other stuff before they're signed off. So
just couldn't afford for it to, fail on a media test. It's got to be right.
What's the media history of your press car?
So it's been in a few really interesting articles. So the first one was November 95. It was in Auto Car. And it was at the time when GoldenEye was coming out, and the headline on it, I think, is this DB7, the car he should be driving, which I thought always tickled me as being a – yeah, and we've got some great pictures from that photo shoot. One is with – I spoke to the photographer who took them, and he said, yeah, I remember that photo shoot. There's Keith Riddington, who was the work service manager at the time, holding a real Walther PPK. And this was right in front of the MI6 building, so it's next to the DB5 car that was in – Golden as well. So that was a really fun shoot. And then the next article it appeared in was it had the title New Improved, and it was going back to a Sunday Times article of a year before where I think, you know, there had been a few problems with the car. And this particular article was talking about, actually, you know, all the problems are fixed. It's really, really solid now. But then there's a few other interesting things I discovered when I was looking into the history. And I only did this like 2 or 3 years ago. I knew it was a press car when I bought it, but it wasn't until 2017, 2018 when I actually got the photos and the articles. There's Simon Le Bon and his wife, Yasmin Le Bon, had it for a weekend. And I thought, that's really nice that, you know, they've been driving around in this press car. So you discover this wonderful history that the car had before you bought it when you buy a press car.
Right. So you've got to play Duran Duran tape in there then.
I've got to do that.
I mean, yeah. Even limited editions. I mean, if you think about it, the one that comes to mind is a Dunhill edition.
Yeah.
Probably the first time we'd ever done a limited, I don't think we'd ever done a limited edition car ever.
Until, that's a good point.
Well, again,
it?
That yes. was the, I had to come up with a colour and trim with that and met with Dunhill down in London to decide what, you know, what we're going to put in there to kind of Dunhill it, Dunhill-ize it. So, you know, the humidor and the cufflinks and the
cigar cutter and
the cigar cutter and various other little accessories that went into
the
car.
There was a smoking version, which was most of them, I think, or there was a non-smoking version, right, wasn't there? I mean, nowadays, be shot for even thinking about putting an ashtray in a car, but back then, cars had ashtrays in.
Well, and Dunhill produced
and Dunhill
cigars, you know.
Cigarettes and cigars. So, yeah, it was a smoking version or a non-smoking version, which I think had the... But the cologne and the perfume or whatever it was, they would, you know, it was smellies basically, you know. But
yes.
In lieu of the humidor, you got a box full of.
And I remember redesigning the center cap on the wheels to have those little ears on them. I don't know if you've ever noticed.
Yes.
Because it was just like a Dunhill watch, which was circular with these little ears where the strap went, just to, again, Dunhillize it. And of course, it was a special silver, black interior with silver piping.
Yeah. Yeah,
actually, a really nice looking car,
stunning car,
and it was ice. Yeah. They're all i6, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And all I think they're all coupe.
I think they were Valentes as well.
Okay, yeah.
Most of the ones you see are coupes, but they were, and a lot of them are on a T-reg if you're in the UK because they were registered in '99, just as the V12 cars were about to come out. Really, but
the Dunhills are very desirable just today if they still got all the accessories with them, aren't they?
Well,
they
that's the thing.
They seem to go.
That's the thing.
They kept, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, we also had, was it one of the versions, we had one of our little telescopic pens.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
The Lamy
pen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were nearly always disappeared.
Oh. Well, they used to be on certain Vantage models. I think you had a Lamy pen that was in the actual dashboard.
Yeah. Into the dashboard,
so
yeah.
One of the buses, you pushed it and the pen popped out. And
Yes.
You know, but again, we're drifting off the DB7.
Another
DB7 special was the Jubilee as well, the 2002 Jubilee cars, which were dreamt up by Stratstone. And there was about 20 or something of them.
Well, that started at this... You know, this sort of dealer limited edition.
Yeah, dealer edition cars.
Dealer editions where they maybe have 10 cars.
Yeah.
As in the Red Arrows or...
And later
small
on,
number,
yeah.
Which continues really to
But really DB7 starts all that off.
That was the first one, I think.
Okay. Andrew, thank you for bringing your car.
Pleasure.
Photos will appear on the website and social media. So looking forward to seeing you at some of our events, and no doubt we'll get you again on the podcast. So thanks for that. Steve, thank you as always. And John, it's been many years and it's been great to see you again.
And you, thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire. So find out more via amht.org.uk.